This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
What's up, preacher man?
A bombing in Manchester, England. We have the details on the Patriot Preacher. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Patriot Preacher, covering the news from a Christian perspective. Welcome to the program, everybody. Good to be with you on this very rainy Tuesday morning. And your hearts and prayers have to go out to everybody involved in the Manchester attack. We don't know, just like with a lot of terrorist attacks, I wouldn't say that we have a lot of information, but interestingly enough, it seems like information is coming out on this one quicker than normally. I'm not sure if that just has something to do with the nature of the attack, or unfortunately, I think the more likely scenario is that we've just gotten really good at covering terrorist attacks because they happen a lot. And I hate to say that, but it seems to me that that's probably the reason that we're able to get some of this out so quickly. Law enforcement's getting better at investigating it. The news is getting more accustomed to running stories like this, unfortunately. And because these attacks have become so commonplace, I think that's the reason we're able to get all this information very quickly. Of course, a lot of that plays into the nature of the attack itself, but these are the latest updates so far. It appears that, right now at least, there have been 22 that have died in this bombing. There were another roughly 60 wounded. I think the latest injury count is 59. Now, that death toll could go up. Maybe some of the people that got injured don't make it through the next few hours, and it's possible that we find more victims. But at least for right now, the official number is 22 dead and roughly 60 wounded. So, dozens wounded in this attack. No telling how many people affected by it, with the victims' families, the people in and around where the bombing happened. The explosion apparently took place just outside of an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, England. Now, I don't know a whole lot about Ariana Grande, but you could probably ask the guys over at Y102, like John and Tommy or Rex on the Radio, and they would know all about her, but I don't know much about her. But what I do know is that her fan base is fairly young, that the vast majority of her fans are teenage girls, maybe a little younger, maybe young adult women. So that's her primary fan base. And unfortunately, because that is her fan base, and because this attack happened directly outside her concert, that's going to be the kind of person who the victims were. So truly, truly tragic to see, because it is horrible as any kind of terrorist attack is. When it happens at for example, a soccer game over there or some kind of sporting event, typically a lot of the victims are adult men, which, not that any one life is particularly more valuable than the other in one sense, but you always hate to see especially women and especially children getting hurt in attacks like this, because you know, they had their whole lives ahead of them. We don't know much about the victims so far, but the vast majority of them probably were young, a lot of them probably female. In fact, the only two victims we know about so far are both female. One was 18, one was 8. Those are the only two victims that have been identified so far. Surely they probably know the identities of a lot of them. It's just that they have held off on making that information public, so really, really rough to watch, really rough to cover. But the latest breaking news is that ISIS is now claiming responsibility for the attack, which we've seen a pattern kind of emerging here, because used to what would happen is ISIS would wait a couple days, claim the attack. It seems like now they're getting a little bolder and claiming them almost immediately after they happen. I'm not sure exactly why the shift in strategy, and again, you have to take things like this with a grain of salt, because sometimes we find out that terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda, like ISIS, were taking responsibility for attacks that they actually had nothing to do with because it increases their notoriety. I'm sure that the investigators are going to be looking into this, looking into who the suicide bomber or the suspected suicide bomber. They believe it's a suicide bomb, and all the evidence right now at least seems to point towards that. That the suspected suicide bomber was influenced by ISIS, was getting direction from ISIS. We don't know that yet. But it's certainly possible. It's a likely scenario for sure. Now, the current information is that a lone suspect detonated what is believed to be an IED, so a bomb that he essentially put together just outside, that it was a suicide bombing. They believe that they knew who it was. They have a suspect, and they have not released that identity yet, but the authorities over there in the United Kingdom have said that they believe they know who this person is, that they have ID'd him, that they know a little bit about him. They just have not released that to the public yet. And part of the reason they haven't is because they're still looking for people that are suspect to be accomplices. Just for example, there is a 23-year-old suspect already in custody that they believe is related to the attack. Now, this could be the bomb maker. It could be the person that orchestrated it. Could be someone that didn't have anything to do with it, and they're just still trying to figure that out. But they do have a 23-year-old suspect in custody that they believe may have had a hand in carrying out this terrorist attack. So, everybody, please pray for the families affected. Pray for the city of Manchester. It's always tragic to see something like this, but we're seeing terrorist attacks pop up all over Europe. Granted, not that many are on a scale this big, and this one's going to get a lot more media coverage because, like I said, a lot of the victims are probably going to be kids. A lot of the victims are going to be women. And so because of that, it's going to get a little more media attention than if the victims were a little bit different or if there were a few less deaths. But I was thinking about it in these terms. It's a shame that things like this have become kind of commonplace. That it's almost, we've gotten kind of numb to what happens. And I hate to say that, and I know that it's not intentional for my part or anybody else's, but it's just a shame that these things have become not all that surprising anymore. I mean, you remember, even though this is nowhere near the scale, with 9/11, the entire world stopped. With the Paris shooting, the world stopped. And now it just seems like these terrorist attacks, of course, they're smaller in scale and more frequent. So that's part of the problem. But seeing people ruthlessly victimized, unfortunately, is not that uncommon for us anymore. And I hate to see that. So pray for the victims, pray for the families, but also pray for us. Because I genuinely do want to live in a world where this kind of thing is unusual, where it doesn't happen all that often. It seems like we have another major terrorist attack every couple months, and that's a real shame. Hopefully we can learn from this, make some decisions that will help us prevent these events from happening, and most importantly, snuff out the people responsible, because that's going to be the biggest step to making attacks like these less frequent. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Whoever is an avowed enemy of God, I scruple not to call him an enemy to his country. John Witherspoon, signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Welcome back, all. You're listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440. And newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers, as always. If you want to call in, let us know what you're thinking. Let me know what you're thinking about this attack, what your reaction to it is. I'm interested to hear what you have to say on it. Now, reading CNN at the moment, they have a new update. The Prime Minister of Britain has come out and talked about the attacker, said that it was a cowardly and callous action. And part of the reason that I think that he's saying that, and he goes on with a longer statement, part of it is that when you're a suicide bomber, it's not the same as being a person that walks into a crowded area, drops a bomb, walks away, detonates it after you're out of the way. You have to, because, I mean, the bomb is you. So you have to be next to the people that you're murdering at the time. You're seeing their faces. You're going through the crowd. And the fact, when you couple that with a lot of these victims are women and children, it really does paint it in a new light that this person knew exactly who he was attacking and did so while he was near them. I mean, seeing the people that he's going to die, that he's going to kill and that are going to die at his hands, it takes a truly soulless person to be able to do that, especially considering who his victims were. Now, ISIS has said on its Telegram channel that this person was a soldier of the Caliphate. We really have no evidence to support that as of yet. They haven't offered any evidence, but we'll hopefully get to the bottom of this. I don't know exactly if there's a preferred method to react with this, but I do know that if it indeed was ISIS, we've got to do something about rooting these people out. Now, Trump actually just recently addressed this particular issue from Israel. He has said, and this is a direct quote from him, "Obliterate this evil ideology," and calls the people responsible the evil losers in life, which it feels like it's really something that only Donald Trump could say, calling someone losers. I mean, it fits his personality. But I don't know if Trump is really on top of how to carry this out, but I appreciate the fact that he has that mentality. Now, don't get me wrong when I say this, Donald Trump is no Ronald Reagan, but it completely changed the way people thought about the Cold War when you had a man in office that was willing to say the communists, yeah, they're the evil empire. He had no problem calling the bad guys the bad guys. And at least for right now, it appears as though Donald Trump is taking the exact same method with that, which is encouraging to see. I'm glad that we have someone in the White House that doesn't have a problem with referring to radical Islamic terrorism as the enemy, that doesn't mind saying, we've got to do something about these people, they're wicked, and saying to the people over there, not only the Saudis, but other Muslim countries that he's been visiting, hang on here, guys. We don't have a problem with Muslims, per se. But we do have a problem with the radical Muslims, the ideology that is coming out of here. So this is something that you guys have to take an active role in staving off. And he calls on all nations to be united in this goal, which I've got to go along with. It's going to take a concerted effort by several different nations because this organization has no legal jurisdiction. They don't have an actual country. They're getting close to being an actual country, but they don't have real legal borders. They don't have an actual established government, and so we have to fight this enemy in a different way, and hopefully we can be able to do that and completely break their spirit, I think, is the best way to start resolving problems like this. And one thing that I did appreciate from the president is he vowed to have Israel's back no matter what, which is a stark contrast from the previous administration. And it's something that I'm glad to see. I think it's a step in the right direction. All right, let's go to the phones. We got Marty on line one. Good morning, Marty.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing quite well. What's on your mind this morning?
Well, what's on my mind is that, one, I'm a veteran, so I believe in, you know, demolishing whoever the enemy is, especially in our country's interest. But I believe that Trump has now finally come to understand why Obama refused to call the Muslim radical Islamic terrorists. Because if you notice, Trump has flipped the script now that he's gone to Saudi Arabia and a few of the other places, and now he's calling them evil losers rather than Islamic radical Islamic terrorists. Because he know that words matter, and they tried to tell him that, but he was canning Obama and canning Hillary for not actually saying the word. And I guarantee you, he won't say that word again because words matter. Now, Obama, as far as the Israelis' policies, it was always a given that we're going to back Israel no matter what. But Obama didn't go out. Obama, if you're going to wage, you know, peace or what have you, you cannot act as though you're on one side or the other when you're waging peace, because your Muslims or, you know, people around the world are no dummies. They know that, you know, we are supporting Israel, but if you're going to go into an agreement or negotiations already tilting the scale towards Israel, you're not going to get any success. So I think Trump has finally started listening to his advisors, and I guarantee you, you will never hear him again say Islamic radical terrorists, because
that's a bold prediction. I don't know that it'll actually come to fruition if he doesn't say it anymore. I think it's a little too early to call that personally. But if he indeed doesn't say that anymore, that is a bold prediction from you. Why is it that you think specifically he won't be using that phrase again?
Because it's propaganda and it's politically incorrect. And the thing is, it does no good. He gave a good speech over in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and a magnificent speech. You see, and the kind on the same level as what Obama has given when he went to Cairo. I say that. Not use those words in the presence of the Sunni Muslims over there in Saudi Arabia. And he didn't use those words when he went to Israel because he knew that they were listening. Those words, because what you're doing when you say radical Islamic terrorists, you are convicting, the entire Muslim faith.
No.
Well,
Marty.
Okay.
Here's the thing. Islam and Muslim are two completely different things. They're associated with one another, but they're not the same thing. Islam means subjection, which means if you are an Islamicist, it's the same thing as being a certain sect of any other religion. You believe in the caliphate, you believe in jihad, so on and so forth. That's all the time I got. Got a hard break coming up.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 13:34-35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers, and if you do want to call in, talk about the attack in Manchester, you can do so. We're going to switch gears here, but if you want to call in and ask about that, we're going to try to keep an eye on this as much as possible throughout the show. The truth is, we just don't have that much information on it yet, and that's part of the reason why we're going to move on here temporarily.
I'm actually monitoring Fox, and you're monitoring CNN.
Right.
It's gotten to the point where nothing is changing as far as the headline. It's just basically repeat. They have to keep us informed, but they don't have anything new.
Yeah. If something pops up, then either someone can call in and let us know, or we're both looking at it right now. So we'll try to keep you up to date as much as humanly possible. But until something new breaks off, I figured we'd cover a little local news here.
And we all know that ISIS is taking responsibility. You mentioned that a few times.
That's the big developing story here. That's what just broke this morning. So we'll be talking about that. Again, if you do have any updates or if we find any new updates here on the news, we'll try to cover that. But until then, we're going to cover a couple different scenarios because we've essentially given you all the news that we've got on this right now. So I was taking an article from AL.com, there was apparently a new bill that was just signed into law by Governor Kay Ivey, which deals with crossover voting. Now, this is kind of a loophole in Alabama's voting system. That's really the best way I know to describe it. I hesitate to use that phrase just because it almost sounds like you're doing something immoral or something like that. It's really not. It's just they believe that there's a hiccup in the system and they wanted to correct it. So the way that it works now is, and we're all familiar with this, when we're involved in some kind of primary, we all go to vote and they say, which ballot would you like? I would like Republican, please. I would like Democrat, please. Whichever side you happen to fall on, they give you your ballot. You vote for the candidate you like, you turn it in, and that's the end of it. Well, there is a hiccup in that system, per se, with special elections that have a runoff, or elections that have a runoff in general, actually. So when there is a primary and that triggers a runoff, then there is no restriction for that same person going to the same polling place and saying, well, this time I would like a Republican ballot, even though I voted Democrat, or vice versa. Not, I don't, you don't actually tell that to the polling person, but that's the scenario that they're worried about here. So what they're saying is you could use it to intentionally sabotage a vote. What this new law does is it prevents people from switching sides during the primaries. So, for example, if I were to, for the special election that's coming up, vote for one of the Democrats in the main primary, and then during the runoff, there are two or three Republican candidates left in the runoff, I can go vote Republican if I want to. Now, this is probably not something that I would do, because frankly I'm not really concerned with any of the Democrat candidates. I've looked into a few of them. There's really nothing there that interests me into having them as a senator for this particular one. And the idea is that what this will do is it prevents intentional sabotage, which the intention there I think is good. In fact, there were a lot of people, and I'm not trying to make this about the most previous election, but it's just the only recent example that I can think of. There were a lot of people that insinuated that that's the reason that Donald Trump won the Republican primaries, because there were a lot of Democrats in states that didn't have closed primaries coming in and intentionally voting for Donald Trump, hoping that he would become the candidate for the Republicans and he would be by far the easiest to beat with Hillary Clinton as their candidate. Now, there's not a lot of evidence that that was going on. It was more of a theory that was unproven. I guess it's possible. I don't know that it would have done nearly enough to have swayed the votes. Maybe it did in some of the really close states. I don't know. But the point is, that theory is plausible, and because that theory is plausible, whether or not it happened, I believe that the intent from the governor and the House and Senate by passing this law was to try to prevent that from happening in Alabama. In other words, if you pick a side to vote for in a primary, you're stuck with that side for the remainder of that particular election. So it makes sense in a way, and I appreciate that they're trying to keep the intentional sabotage vote from happening. However, there is a genuine question I have here, because put yourself in this scenario. Let's just say, for the sake of arguing, and I'm giving a hypothetical scenario here, of course, but let's just say for the sake of the argument that you voted for the Republican primary and you voted for one person that didn't make it to the runoff. And that was the only Republican that you liked. You wanted to support him. You wanted to throw your weight behind him. But now that he's out, there's a runoff coming up. You don't like either of the two Republican candidates, but you do like the runoff that's taking place. You like one Democrat better than the other. He wasn't your first choice because your first choice was in the Republican primary, but now you want to vote for one of the two in the Democrat runoff. Well, that's a perfectly legitimate reason for wanting to vote the opposite side of the way that you did in the primary. And so, though I think it's probably very uncommon for that to actually happen, I do feel as though there are, on occasion, legitimate reasons for wanting to switch which ballot you have between the primary and the runoff. Like I said, maybe the candidate that you really liked didn't win, didn't make it to the runoff, and because of that, you're wanting to switch sides. So, it is possible, at least in theory, that you had a genuine change of heart. Who knows, maybe you even changed your political affiliation in a very short amount of time. Now, I wonder how genuine that change is, but if maybe you even change parties between the primary and the runoff. So there's a few things that I think may be legitimate excuses for wanting to be able to do the crossover vote.
But sometimes, not always, but there are people who go to the polls and they're not really Republican or Democrat. And they want to vote for the candidate. And I mean, they are the one, or a lot of them, I imagine, are ones who not necessarily switch parties, but vote in a different primary, which is a different thing from switching parties, because they never had a party to begin with.
Right, and that's that is a possibility. You could be an independent, which technically I'm an independent. Well, if you're getting super technical, everyone in the state is independent because we don't have registration.
So you just kind of want to pick and choose. Yeah, we don't and never have. I don't guess we have. You know more than I would. I don't know.
Hey, I don't think we've ever had it to where you actually register. Now, it is important to note, and I wanted to bring this to everyone's attention, that this new law will be in effect in time for the special elections. So, with the senator filling Jeff Sessions' vacant Senate seat that is right now occupied by Luther Strange as appointed by Governor Bentley, this will be in effect. And it's important to know that because runoffs are pretty likely in this particular election because there are 11 Republicans and 8 Democrats, which means there's a very, very good chance that we're going to have at least one, if not two, runoffs, one for the Republicans, one for the Democrats, to decide who will be each party's candidate for the Senate seat once occupied by Jeff Sessions. So just be aware of that, that now that the new law is in effect, if you pick a party, you got to stick with it. You can't switch sides. Even if you really want to, or even if you have a genuine reason to, you're stuck with the side that you picked the first time. And again, I like the intent of trying to get rid of the sabotage vote because it's never a good idea, regardless of who you are, to vote for a candidate you don't really believe in to try to get your candidate in by sabotaging the other side. First of all, that's a misuse of your vote. Second of all, I mean, it's not immoral or it's not illegal, but honestly, I think it's dishonest.
Yeah, I do too. I was going to ask if you didn't think there was some immoral. I mean, I'm not putting it down there with the worst of the worst, but a little immoral. I would feel really kind of bad. I would not be proud of myself for doing it.
No, and that's the thing. Hillary Clinton, for example, again, I'm just using the most recent election as an example. I thought Hillary Clinton was the most beatable candidate, but I would have never gone into the primary and put my name beside Hillary Clinton. Yes, I want Hillary Clinton as the candidate for the Democrat Party, even if I thought she was the easier person to beat, because A, it shows that you're really just a party line person because you don't really care who your candidate is as long as the other candidate is easier to beat. And second of all, you're essentially putting your name next to the candidate that winds up getting in. And I wonder if, again, there's no evidence to show that there was a massive impulse of Democrats that were voting for Donald Trump because they actually wanted him to lose. There might have been some, but the few that did, I wonder how they feel right now that Donald Trump's in office and they feel that they may have played a very small part in that. So that's another reason you don't vote in the other party's primary for someone you don't really like just to make it easier to win, because who knows, you may have helped that person get elected. But regardless, it's important to use your vote wisely and to use it to support people that you actually believe in. And I've always believed that that was the primary purpose of voting, regardless of how it's done. Wanted to mention this before we go to a break. Talk about my good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. These people have been in business for 50 years. They know this business. They know the people in this town. They know the town. And that's the reason they've been able to stay in business for 50 years. They can do anything from oil change, an air filter replacement, rotating your tires, to major engine repair. So anything that you need done, go by and see my friends today at Jim Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center, located on the Troy Highway right there in beautiful South Montgomery. Check them out today. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Colossians 3:17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440, as always, are the numbers. And I wanted to...
you are definitely psychic. We were off mic or off air. We were talking about Alan Dershowitz.
Oh, Alan Dershowitz is making the news now?
And there he is, right there.
Huh.
Evil losers in life.
Yep, that's what Donald Trump said this morning.
But Dershowitz is there in the
Fascinating.
Yeah, there it is.
Dershowitz does an awful lot of commentary, especially when it comes to Israel. I think he's the one that wrote the book A Case for Israel. So he's very politically involved in that. But that's funny. We were talking about him.
I know we were talking. It's funny, what's funny is how many times you just seem to connect with something before it really happens. Now, and I'm not making that up. We talk about that.
Yeah, I definitely have some level of precognition because, and I'm going to get to this later in the show, Kevin Elkins was talking this morning about the godship of Jesus, the divinity of him, and the subject of my Star Spangled Sermon, which comes up at the end of the show every day, tune in to check that out, is on that subject. And I didn't plan that. It actually came from a conversation I was having with a brother last night. I just felt an inkling to use that verse, and I used exactly the verse that I would have told Kevin if I'd been in on that conversation.
And there's so many times on and off the air where I will say something, oh, yeah, I was just going to say that, or it's eerie.
Well, I don't know exactly why that's the case, but...
But it's beginning to be...
I'm spooking my producer over here is what the takeaway should be.
I need to not think anything unless he's going to pick my mind.
But just wear one of those aluminum foil hats and you'll be all right. But anyway, so I did want to mention that with this bill, and I do want to hear if any of y'all have a opinion on this, if you would like to be able to still do a crossover vote, if you like the fact that other people can't vote crossover and quote-unquote ruin the primary for you, you can call in now. I will say, though, one thing that this bill does that's kind of an addendum, obviously what we've been talking about is the main purpose of this bill. One thing that the bill does is it also allows for electronic sign-ins instead of paper. So the goal with that is if you have the equipment and you want to buy it in whatever your voting precinct is, then you can actually sign in without the paper. So instead of going up, signing your name, and then having them check you off and move down the row, then what they will be doing is if your precinct wants to participate in it, they have a option for electronic sign-in. So you'll essentially go to a screen and select your name and sign in that way, which theoretically, at least, will make things a little bit faster, and I'm glad to see that they were opting for that. I hope that that'll work out well. Now, on the main purpose of the bill itself, I think the bill is pretty good for the system that we have. Honestly, I don't see a big problem. If there are some legitimate people that do want to do the crossover vote, I don't think that it's going to affect them all that much, or if it does... I mean, that's a very rare scenario where you legitimately want to vote for one candidate in the primary and you vote for him and he doesn't make it, so you switch over to vote for the other candidate's runoff or the other party's runoff. It can happen. I'm not saying that it doesn't, and I'm not saying those that would like to do that don't have a legitimate issue with this bill. However, I am making the case that that's incredibly rare, and typically if that happens, it is because somebody is intentionally trying to sabotage a primary and vote for and support a candidate on the other side of the one they want to win, who they believe will be easier to defeat. Again, it doesn't happen that often. I don't think it's a huge deal. However, I will say that even though this bill is pretty good for the system that we have, I think it highlights a flaw in our system. Because if we're going to continue to do primaries the way that we do, where it's an open primary, but you're only allowed to vote for one or the other, this bill is probably pretty good. But frankly, it bothers me that they keep anyone from voting in either primary because it's state-funded. And so this was a running issue that I've had with Republicans for a long time, primarily because I'm a libertarian, or... I have very libertarian leanings, I'll put it that way. I'm not a Republican, and I'm not a registered Republican. If we moved to closed primaries and you had to register, I would just not vote in primaries. I would, of course, still vote in the general, but I would not be voting in primaries because I wouldn't be allowed to. So, that being said, when you're looking at it from that angle, there are Republicans that get upset with me over that just because I would rather it not be state-funded. Because I don't think that when you're talking about a private organization like the Alabama GOP or the Alabama Democrats, that they should be funding primaries. any more than I think that the state should be funding the libertarian primaries. And yes, those are a real thing. They're just not all that publicized. So that being said, they're private organizations, and if they want to close off their primaries to people that are not registered Republicans or registered Democrats, more power to them. Do it all day long if that's what you want, even if I'm singled out in that. However, pay for it yourself. Don't use my taxpayer dollars that go to the state of Alabama to fund a primary that your party is carrying out. And that's really the problem that I have with the system as it all. I think, even though it would mean I wouldn't be able to vote in primaries, I think that it would be better for the state and better for the parties themselves if they privately funded those primaries, got the state out of it altogether, and then it's not a government function anymore. And then they could do whatever they wanted to with it. If the Democrats want to close off their primary, the Republicans want to close off their primary to only members, that's fine. If they want to leave it open, that's fine too. And in fact, I would rather them leave it open just because it benefits me personally. But as a private organization, as long as they're not using state dollars to do it, I got no problem with them closing it off. They can do what they want to. So I think that that's the better way to handle it, even though it personally kind of leaves me out in the cold. And typically that is my instinct with most things, is if the government doesn't have to fund it, the government probably shouldn't fund it. And I think that this is no different. I would have no issue whatsoever with them setting up their own system. I don't even necessarily have a problem with them having access to the state database to ensure that they're not getting voter fraud in their primaries. That's fine too. But pay for it yourself. That's all I'm asking. All right, so we are going to go to the second hour real quick. Before we go, I did want to mention, shop local as much as you can. We have local companies here in Montgomery that do a great job, like El Ranchero Grande, Central Financial, and Shane's Rib Shack. So check them out today. Buy local, shop local, support our local businesses. We'll be back. Hour two coming up. Won't you know you can never go back? I gotta take it on the other side.
A century that what it meant to me. This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, as always, are the numbers. I'm Caleb Colquitt. Glad to be with you on a Tuesday morning. The story that came out of New Orleans is that we've covered this. We talked about it when it started. They have begun removal of the last of the four Confederate memorials they had been talking about taking away in New Orleans. Now, part of the reason I bring this up and part of the reason that I believe that it relates to you is that New Orleans is a typically very liberal city, but it is in the South. It's in a conservative state. And if this can happen there, I don't believe that it's very far out of the realm of possibility that sometime soon similar events could take place here. Keep in mind, we're the home of the first capital of the Confederacy. We have the first Confederate White House here. There are several monuments and markers that talk about some of the events going on in the Civil War, honoring those that were involved in it, that were fighting for it. The last monument they removed was the memorial statue that they had of General Robert E. Lee. Now, it's important to understand some of the historic background of what's going on here, because like I said before, when I went through each and every one of the memorials that were being removed of one of the local generals there from Louisiana that was played an incredibly important role, also honoring the group that actually fought against New Orleans' own government trying to reinstitute some of the slavery laws and basically wanting to go back to the way things were before the war happened. And then you also had statues of Robert E. Lee and Confederate President Jefferson Davis. The last one that was removed was Robert E. Lee. And while I could certainly see at least the argument for a couple of the memorials being a testament to terrible decisions that were happened by people that were less than reputable, specifically in the case of Jefferson Davis, it's important to understand that Robert E. Lee's not really in the same category, and here's why. First of all, Robert E. Lee never bought a slave in his entire life. He did own slaves, which he inherited from his wife, but he released them long before the Civil War was even ended. So it was his option. He made the call to release his slaves. This is before the 13th Amendment was enacted. Robert E. Lee, based on the convictions of his own conscience, decided to release his slaves. He often spoke out against slavery, saying it was a moral and political evil that needed to be abolished. So the idea that Robert E. Lee's statue should be taken away and Robert E. Lee should essentially wind up on the dustbin of history, the ash heap of history, as it were, because he fought for the Confederacy, to me is a little disingenuous, and it doesn't look at the whole picture. Now, granted, we know from his personal writings that even though Robert E. Lee had no personal problems with black people, he did not regard them as equal. But in that sense, he really isn't much different from Abraham Lincoln. Because as many of the wonderful things Abraham Lincoln did, even in his own arguments against slavery, which he made frequently, and you can look them up, he never asserted that blacks were equal to white people. Not saying that that makes it okay, not saying that they were right in that. Absolutely, the furthest thing could be, that is the furthest thing from the truth, and I've been very vocal about my stances on it myself. But what I am saying is we need to give a little historic context when observing people that lived in a different time. I mean, we give people, politicians, passes all the time nowadays on stances that they held 2-4 years ago and pretend that they never held that stance, on both sides, by the way. And yet we can't offer a little perspective on historic figures and them maybe not believing the right way on a couple of issues completely washes out all the other accomplishments in their life. Robert E. Lee was a very valiant man, a brilliant strategist. Lee's own enemies treated him with more respect than a lot of people do today. The people that he fought against didn't even necessarily believe that he was a bad guy. We see the mutual respect during the surrender when he surrendered his sword to General Grant after he had been defeated at Appomattox Courthouse. So I think that we do a disservice by trying to discount any good, any valor that a person accomplishes in their life and remembering only one thing about them that was less than correct. I mean, obviously, I disagree with some of the things that Lee said himself, but there's rarely a historic figure that I agree with absolutely everything on. So it's important to remember that Lee was against slavery. But it's also important to remember that during the beginning of the Civil War, both sides were pro-slavery. There were still two United States states that had slaves. And the stated reason for the war was to end the, essentially to bring the states that had seceded from the Union back into the Union. Now, slavery was a very important part of that issue. There's no doubt about that. Slavery was a major cause of the Civil War, and it was one of the hot-button issues of the day that they debated over. But to say that it was the only thing that mattered is simply historically inaccurate. Because at the time, if the war had ended maybe 2 years earlier than it did, you could make a good historic argument from looking at the history of that, that if it had been brought in 2 years earlier, that slavery still would have been legal. So keep in mind, even the Emancipation Proclamation did nothing to free the slaves in the two states that still remained a part of the Union, that still bore slaves. So it's important to understand the the historic context of that. And this is another question that I want to ask. Really put yourself in the mind of Robert E. Lee and where he was. Would you be willing to fight your friends, your neighbors, your family, your own children? Because had Lee fought for the Union and he was an officer in the Army, had he not seceded, he would have had to fight the people in his own home state, in his own community, raised a sword against his own children. Would you be willing to do that? It's an important question to ask ourselves to really understand the position that Robert E. Lee was in. We'll talk more about this in a moment. We'll be right back.
But we were so poor that we couldn't tell. Cotton was short and the weeds were tall. But Mr. Roosevelt was gonna save us all.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 8:31 and 32. So Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free."
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. Call in 860-1440 if you want to weigh in. Interested to hear what you have to say about it, because I'm sure there's a myriad of opinions on this. I got to be honest, I have a myriad of opinions on this, just me as a single person. So Joe and I were just talking about that. It's a tough call to make in some ways, but I don't have any misgivings about what I'm saying about Robert E. Lee, because I'm just talking about history.
And you have really presented, from what I've read, you've presented a very fair image of Robert E. Lee, and I know your stance on Jefferson Davis, too.
Yeah, I do not like Jefferson Davis.
I know. I never did really dislike him that much, but you seem to be really adamant about his character, about who he was.
Well, I mean, he's not the worst person to ever exist in history, but he got elected in a lot of ways on a message of white supremacy, and that really bothers me.
Well, I've got a hypothetical question. It is sort of a monument. You know, the star where he took the oath of office,
right?
It's still there on the Capitol steps, or at the entrance to the Capitol. Would you be in favor of removing that because Jefferson Davis was, you know, not really moral, not really...
I don't, and this was the argument that I made when we talked about this story previously. Even when it comes to Jefferson Davis, who I've made fairly clear I'm not a fan of, I don't necessarily mind there being monuments to people that were less than reputable, and the reason that I say that is it opens the doorway to a conversation, because that tells me that not only Jefferson Davis was not a one-off, that there were other people that really believed the things that he believed, and that there was a consensus amongst a lot of people in the South, which encourages my historic curiosity to ask why and to understand that.
And I hate to use the word moral. I hate to really label anybody as being moral or in the sense that we think of it, but he also, and maybe a better question would be that statue that he has on the North Lawn of the Capitol, the memorial to him. Well, I guess it is a statue.
Yeah, it's definitely a statue. This is how I'll phrase it. I'm in favor of keeping it just because, again, it encourages historic curiosity. It's a testament to who we are, where we've been, that kind of thing, good or bad. I like seeing history completely exposed and naked and without a lot of context, and this is why.
Can't change it. And
no, you can't.
Maybe the state of Alabama should put a little disclaimer, a little sign around it that says, we don't endorse what Jefferson Davis stood for, but here it is. Here's his, you know, don't blame us.
I don't know. I think that's editorializing on something that's supposed to be purely historic. But again, I'll say it this way. I was real upset that the General Lee statue's coming down. I'm not as upset about the Jefferson Davis statue coming down. I'm still antsy about it because it's history, but I'm
I'm certainly more upset that the General Lee statue is coming down. That's the reason that I've made it the focus of this segment.
And it's also standing and has forever in front of Robert E. Lee High School. So, yeah, I was wondering.
Right,
I guess we could go on with hypotheticals all day.
Right. But
would they change the name of the school?
Actually, I think they already have opted for changing the name of Robert E. Lee Elementary. Now, the high school, I don't know if there's any plans on changing that. I know that people have suggested it for a long time. In fact, I've had conversations with people on the air about that. But anyway, so this is the question that I left you with at the end of the last break. Would you be willing to fight and kill your own friends, neighbors, and children? Because that is the position that Robert E. Lee found himself in. Virginia, his home state, the place he had spent his entire life, was now seceding. They were no longer going to be a part of the United States of America. And so Lee was left with the choice. I can take an active role in raising a sword against my own friends, my own neighbors, people that I love, people that I've grown up with, my own family, my own children. Or I can stay with Virginia and secede. Robert E. Lee actively opposed secession. He was a very outspoken critic of it. And I think part of that was in no small part that you could see D.C. from his house. But at the same time, regardless of what his motivation was, he was actively against secession. But once secession happened, he felt that he could not oppose Virginia. Because, keep in mind, especially being the very accomplished general that he was, he would have had a very active role in coming up with battle strategies and tactics to actively work towards killing people that he knew. And so that's part of the reason that, looking at it in the context of the Civil War, that's why it was called Brother Against Brother, because it really was. There were people on both sides that had loved ones, family, friends that were on both sides. And so Lee was put in an incredibly difficult position. And whether or not you believe the war was fought over slavery, and I would dispute that, but let's take that out of the argument completely. Whether or not you believed that the war was fought over slavery, Lee didn't. He took it as the South fighting for its independence. You may disagree with that, and that's fine, but I'm telling you that was his motivation. And so when we're looking at it in that context, the things that he did, he believed them to be in the right, and he was a valiant man, respected by everyone, including his enemies. He was the epitome of a true Southern gentleman, and he did the best to maintain that facade in every social circumstance that he arose in. And again, even his enemies respected him and had a great reverence for him. So I want to move on to that now that we've kind of understood that and understood who General Lee is. Why do you think that there are people that are so gung-ho about removing the monuments? Well, we do know that regardless of what side of the political spectrum you fall on, typically the people that are in favor of removing monuments associated with the Confederacy happen to be politicians and are usually Democrats. And I genuinely think that part of it, even if they don't realize it, is because they remind the Democrats of who they were. Because, keep in mind, they view the Confederacy as solely slavery, had nothing to do with anything else, and as such, anyone associated with it must be historically seen as an outcast, a racist, a slave owner. They all must be viewed with the same kind of vitriol. And part of the irony and the cognitive dissonance that comes with that is that who was in charge of the South? The Democrats. It was known as the Solid South for the Democrats. Keep in mind, the Democrats owned the House right here in the state of Alabama for 136 years. And when it comes to everything on the national stage, it was the Democrats that fought hard to preserve slavery. The founder of the Democrat Party, the modern Democrat Party as we understand it, was President Andrew Jackson, who was incredibly in favor of slavery and maintaining it. And for the longest time, really up until the 13th Amendment, it was the Democrats, not the Republicans, that were in favor of slavery. Fast forward a few hundred years, it was the Democrats, not the Republicans, that were in favor of Jim Crow laws. And so I really do think that the reason that Democrats get so touchy about it is because it reminds them of what their party was and who they were. And because of that, they kind of want to get rid of the history so there's not anybody asking a whole lot of questions about it. Let's not forget that just recently at Princeton, the Black Student Union wanted Woodrow Wilson's name removed from one of their halls because they found out that Woodrow Wilson, another Democrat president, was a pretty outspoken racist and did not care for black people all that much. In fact, he screened a Klan movie right there in the White House, the first movie ever screened within the walls of the White House. So I think that part of the reason they want these monuments gotten rid of is because it reminds people of who the Democrats used to be. And they're ashamed of that. And should be. But regardless, I think another reason that they would remove the monuments is because it robs people of the whole understanding of the person. Because for their narrative to work, it benefits them for people to see everybody in the Confederacy as evil, racist. There was only one issue that ever contributed to the Civil War, and that was, of course, the institution of slavery. The more they can paint that narrative in that direction, the better it is for them politically. Even though that's not the case, and maybe seeing a statue of Robert E. Lee, there's a kid walking by, why would they have a statue up of Robert E. Lee? Wasn't he a bad guy? Well, that encourages him to do a little bit of research. And once he does that research, he might find what we've just been talking about, that it's not really that simple. And the vast majority of people that fought for the Confederacy didn't view it as fighting for slavery. Some of them did. Some of them were pretty outspoken about it. But there were some that weren't. And there were a lot of people on the North that wanted to win the war, but they were still for slavery. And so it's not as easy to sort through that historically unless you really do your research and dig into it and start viewing people as individuals, not as a mass. I believe that removing these monuments discourages historic curiosity. And this is what I'm really concerned about. I'm worried that the founders are next. Because there will be people, and actually there are people that already have made this case before, just there's not that many of them yet, that have said because Jefferson and Washington and other significant founders owned slaves that they were racist that ought not be honored. Which, by the way, there's a lot more to that story. In fact, Thomas Jefferson fought in three different court cases trying to get slavery abolished. And George Washington tried to free his own slaves and was legally prevented from it for a while. And so there's a lot more to that story, but it's a lot easier to just look at historical figures as either good guys or bad guys and do no more investigation than that. And there are people, not saying all Democrats, not saying, you know, not trying to paint with a broad brush myself, but there are people in this country that would a lot rather you believe that narrative and not question things. And that's why I think that this movement to remove history exists. All right, we'll be back. 860-1440 are the numbers.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
As to Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, I think the system of morals in his religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. Benjamin Franklin.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers, as always, if you want to call in, talk about anything that we've brought up. It seems like there hasn't been any new updates on the Manchester bombing, or at least nothing significant that we've seen so far. We've had some people commenting on it, but as far as actual development in this story, any details on it, we don't have anything yet, so we'll continue to keep a look at that. Probably won't be anything until tomorrow's show, so just be aware of that, keep an eye on it, and remember the families of the victims and the victims themselves, because there's several that are injured right now, in your prayers. Did want to mention this before we move on. The Sounds of Summer concert series returns to the Shops at East Chase Thursday, June the 1st. This free event, hosted by News Radio 1440, kicks off at 6, with River Dan taking the stage at 7. Enjoy the music and fun, including kids' activities, food vendors, and your chance to win $50 at the Shops at East Chase gift card. We'll see you at the Sounds of Summer with the Shops of East Chase and News Radio 1440. So be sure to check that out coming up June the 1st. Also, I wanted to bring this up because I thought this was too good not to mention during the show. Apparently, there is a fake paper going around that wound up getting actually published by a double peer-reviewed journal. And the subject matter is what makes this really interesting. It was on gender studies. The only problem with it is it's not real.
How amazing. You mean there's fake news out there?
Oh, it's not fake news, but it's definitely fake reports. So gender studies, as most of you know, it's essentially the study of gender and how it affects our culture. It's a field of study in academia, and it's useful for pretty much just that. Which these guys did this as a prank. It was a group of students. They're involved in academics as well, just not in that particular field. So none of them actually have degrees in gender studies. They got together, and I can't even read most of the article because it's not necessarily bad language, but this being a family show, I kind of decided to refrain from it. It's not like cussing or anything. It's just it's a little bit racy in its language.
Clinical? No, not.
They're using anatomically correct phrases an awful lot.
Okay.
And that's how I'll say it.
In other words, clinically.
Right.
Whatever.
And so I decided, just for the discretion being the better part of valor, that I would stay away from reading the actual text of it. But the truth is, you wouldn't get anything out of reading it anyway, because the entire thing's made up. And the writers themselves said, yeah, we made this up just to see if we could get it published. So they pulled this massive prank. And they had a random word generator actually help them with this. And so they just put in a few key phrases that they knew that gender studies use over and over again, and threw it in there and borrowed heavily from this random word generator. Here's what was interesting about this. They said afterward, after this thing got published, anyone who says that they understand this is lying, because we don't understand it and we're the ones that wrote it.
No.
And they made it. They used fake sources, so their citations don't even really exist. It's all fake citations. None of the things that they were citing as their sources were real sources, even though, according to the journal, when they got back news, they did a thorough investigation of all the sources, which just goes to prove they actually didn't. And their policy was, according to them, that they would read, when one person wrote a paragraph, they would pass it around to the other people involved in the prank. And if anybody at the table understood it, they changed it to make it not able to be understood. So they really, ironically, did their homework on this fake article that they wrote. And they went out of their way to make sure that if any paragraph, they're like, yeah, I understood where you were going, they changed it to make sure it didn't make any sense. And somehow this thing still wound up getting published in not just a peer-reviewed journal, a double peer-reviewed journal, which means they went through it twice, and two different organizations that specialize in gender studies went through it, and somehow this thing still winds up getting published. Which, if nothing else, just goes to prove that the whole gender studies field is nothing but drivel. They don't even know what they're talking about.
Who published it?
I don't have the name of the organization right in front of me because it's not provided in the news story, but it just it's hilarious to me that these gender studies organizations that are supposed to be academic elites, they don't actually do their own homework on this. Apparently they don't even understand their own field of study, which to me is hilarious. And the whole idea of a gender studies major or gender studies in general, to me, the thing that's hilarious about that is they are essentially a self-propagating major. And what I mean by that is, and I'm not saying that any field of study that does this is useless, because this is essentially the way philosophy is, and I love philosophy, but the only purpose that gender studies plays in society is to make other gender studies majors. In other words, you can't get a job with a gender studies degree. You can't do anything productive with it except teach other people about gender studies. Now, again, that doesn't mean that it is on its surface useless. It's useless for other reasons. But when it comes to things like English and philosophy, that's really the only job you can get with those majors as well. And that's okay if you're in the field of academics. But when it comes to gender studies, they don't even provide a useful service like knowing how to speak the language or understanding philosophy through a historical context. This is the epitome of useless, self-perpetuating academics. That really all they can do is talk to one another about it, and apparently they don't even understand when the other person is talking, because this thing that they went out of their way to make no sense apparently passes for real academic intellectualism. What this goes to show is that the emperor has no clothes. You remember that children's story?
Oh, yeah, and I think of that a lot, too, especially but getting back to politics and Trump, back especially during the campaign. That's exactly what came to mind. Nobody wants to tell him he doesn't have any clothes. So just everything that comes out of his mouth is, at least by his supporters, is that's it. It's the truth.
Now, there were quite a few moments in the campaign that Trump would say something, and I was just kind of looking at the people around me in the room thinking, did anybody else get that, or did that not make any sense to y'all either?
I think of that a lot. Emperor has no clothes.
Well, in this particular scenario, I think it's kind of the same thing. It seems that they're all very proud of their academics, and they want to pretend like they all understand it, so they're all just standing around, oh, yeah, yeah, the pre-postmodern characterization of the male stereotype. Yeah, we totally know what that means. That's that good paper there. Nobody knows what it means. Nobody can know what it means.
Do they have that? Do they have gender studies at Auburn?
I don't know. It wasn't something that I was interested in, so honestly, I didn't check while I was there.
Well, for once, I'm not picking on Auburn as much as I was kind of picking your brain because you went there, and I thought maybe you would know.
I never ran into a gender studies person, so if it is a major there, I never ran into any of them. Considering I was in the liberal arts building an awful lot, I feel like I would know if they have it, but, you know, it's possible somehow it escaped my notice. Either way, though, it was it's just interesting, and it shows how useless some of this stuff is that they don't even understand it. But just something to think about. I think we do have a problem in the academic community that there are too many people, and this maybe doesn't even necessarily apply to just gender studies. I think it applies more to them. But to a lot of majors that are out there that don't have any practical application, that we're so worried about appearing intelligent in front of other people that nobody's willing to say, yeah, that didn't make any sense. So, just something to think about. We got the Star Spangled Sermon coming up in just a second. My whole life some gal would giggle and I'd turn red and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I'll tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 13:34-35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers, and for those of you who have been listening since Decisions with Kevin Elkins, I know that you may think that I had this planned or I adjusted this based on what Kevin was saying this morning, but I promise I did not know that this was going to take place. I actually had this written last night before the show ever aired, and so it was just a interesting coincidence that I'm actually talking about the subject matter that Kevin was talking about on his show, which was the divinity of Christ. This actually came about, and the reason that I selected this topic is because of a conversation I had with a fraternity brother last night. We were discussing some of this, so it's just interesting how things work out and how some things seem to fit together like that. So Jesus is teaching about eternal life in this particular passage, and he's talking about how we're going to be able to live forever. He talks about people that come to me, my disciples, will not see death. And so this is the discussion he's having, and of course the Pharisees are having some issues with it, as they normally do. They don't like what he's saying. They don't understand it. And so they're challenging him on some of his statements. This passage comes from John 8, 52 through 57. The Jews said to him, "Now we know that you have a demon. Abraham died, and the prophets also. You say, 'If anyone keeps my word, he will never taste of death.' Surely you are not greater than our father Abraham, who died. The prophets died too, whom ye make yourself out to be." Jesus answered, and keep in mind, that's important, whom do you make yourself out to be? They're asking him, "Who are you, Jesus? Who are you saying that you are?" Jesus answered, "If I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say he is our God. And you have not come to know him, but I know him. And if I say that I do not know him, I will be a liar like you. But I know him and keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad." Jesus is not only asserting his authority and his eternal nature, but at least the way they're viewing it, he's diminishing theirs. He's explaining to them, look, I'm greater than the disciple, I'm greater than the prophets, I'm greater than Abraham. In fact, since you're talking about Abraham, since you guys brought him up, Abraham looked forward to the day that I would come to earth. Abraham was waiting for that to take place. And that's one of the things that he's saying that really cuts them to the quick. He's saying, you're claiming to be on Abraham's side, but Abraham was waiting on me. Abraham was wanting to see the day that I came to earth. He would have been glorified. He would have been overjoyed to see my coming. And why is that? Because Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment of the covenant of Abraham. Remember the promise that God made to Abraham all the way back in Genesis? God says to Abraham, through your seed, all nations of the earth will be blessed. And eventually, many years later, through a lot of generations of Abraham's children, from the seed of Judah, there came Jesus Christ. And through his death, no more is God's teachings and his law set apart specifically for the nation of Israel, but as Jesus himself said, it's open to all nations, that all nations are going to be blessed through the giving of Jesus Christ and his death. That was the purpose of Abraham. That was the purpose of the nation of Israel, is to provide the Christ, to provide salvation for the rest of the world. And Jesus is saying, I am the ultimate fulfillment of the promise that God made to Abraham. And then he explains himself. In John 8, 57 through 59, so the Jews said to him, you are not yet 50 years old. Have you seen Abraham? And Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. Therefore, they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. So what is Jesus actually saying here? Well, first of all, he's asserting and answering their question that even though he's not 50 years old, at least in physical terms, he has seen Abraham, because before Abraham existed, before Abraham was born, I am. Meaning Jesus transcends time, that he is eternal, that he was with God in the beginning, as John 1 points out, that he continues to exist now in God's presence, and that he will always exist. And the word I am is what's truly significant. Because what is God's name? Well, loosely translated, because of course Hebrews has no vowels, God's name is I am, Yahweh. That goes all the way back to the burning bush with Moses. Because Moses said, God, who am I supposed to tell these people who sent me? And God simply replies, tell them I am has sent you. That's one of the most significant passages in all of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. And the reason that the Jews revered it back then just as they do now is because it was God giving himself a name. It was God saying, this is what I am. This is my name. This is who I am. And think about how all-encompassing that is. I am existence. Jesus is saying, I am. He's saying, the person talking to Moses through the burning bush, that was me. The person that saw the promise of Abraham, that was me. I always existed, and I continue to exist. And he's referring to himself by the same name that God refers to himself as. The Pharisees understood this all too well. That's why they were angry. That's why they wanted to kill him, is because they understood what Jesus was saying is, I am God. I am the divine Yahweh that has always existed, the person that you worship, or at least claim to worship. And because, see, there was no misunderstanding here. The Pharisees understood exactly what he was saying. And that's why they were so upset. These people who knew the laws of God, they knew the Torah, they knew the stories, they understood what Jesus was saying, and that's why they were so angry. That's why they were convinced that he was blaspheming. See, they couldn't discredit him. They really couldn't disprove what he was saying. And so their only recourse that they could think of was try to kill him. Now, it's interesting to me that it says Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. That to me seems a little impractical from a human standpoint. He's standing up in front of everybody and preaching, and then all of a sudden he, quote unquote, hides himself and gets away. I think there was probably some kind of divine intervention there. But the point of this whole story is that this is Jesus saying that he is one with the Father, that he is God, that it was through him the Father spoke to Moses. And if we look at, for example, Ephesians chapter 4, we know that it's also Jesus through whom the world was created. And so he is asserting his divine nature and asserting his eternity and his oneness with God all in one fell swoop by saying that I am, naming himself, saying that his name is the same as God's name, asserting that they are one and the same. You see, the Pharisees didn't misunderstand. They understood. They just refused to accept it. And if we refuse to accept it, we'll meet a similar fate. Stay the course, friends.
The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.